The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue reading the article we began last week, titled Shattered, the Youngest Victims of Belgian Rule, by Jocelyn C. Zuckerman. I've had this bag for 40 years, Bittu Bingu said, setting down a black and gold striped canvas carry-all on her dining room table. The soft-spoken mother of seven moved to this quaint village in Belgium in 1981 after the death of her Congolese husband. I wanted my children to be people of the world, she said. A few years later, she traveled back to the mission in Kentende and asked for the Mother Superior, now a Congolese woman, for access to the school's old files. She was given the key to a rickety armoire, inside of which she found piles of old folders. I took everything, she said. She opened a faded blue exam book with the word Moulatresses written on the cover in neat cursive. At the top of the first page appears the date September 1958, in the same careful hand. 23 names, including those of Bittu Bingu, Nugalula, and Tavares Muyinga, are listed underneath. Fernandez pulled out a feuille de route, or travel order, along with a road map with instructions on how to get to Kentende. Among the documents Bittu Bingu collected was a 1953 telegram informing the nuns that an agent would be accompanying her friend, Nugalula, and her two brothers to the school. L'enfant mulâtre vient de Brooke-Simon, it reads. Né le 13th, 4, 1950. Nugalula hadn't known her father's last name until Bittu Bingu returned from Congo with the files. They didn't want to give me the name Vandenbroek, Nugalula says softly. That's me, Bittu Bingu said, pointing to an impish-looking child in a group photograph. She's the one who punished me, she went on, singling out a nun and describing how once, after climbing a tree at the age of 8 or 9 to pick oranges, Bittu Bingu had been ordered to harvest habanero chilies every morning for a week. Repeatedly thrusting her throbbing fingers in and out a bucket of water, had done nothing to relieve the excruciating burning sensation that resulted. The bag also held some newer documents. Bittu Bingu pulled out correspondence when Queen Fabiola from the year that she arrived in Belgium. I was really sure my queen was going to help me because I had never asked her for anything, she said. Tavares Muyinga, who moved to Belgium from Congo in 1988, after the death of her mixed-race husband, also said that she'd written to the Queen. I am here in Belgium, the letter said. My husband is dead. I have 4 children. I could use a little help. Both women received replies on thick letterhead featuring a pink embossed crown that assured them that the Queen had read their letters. She referred them to the Public Centers for Social Assistance, Belgium's welfare administration. It wasn't thanks to the government, but Bittu Bingu has enjoyed one victory along the way. In early 2014, one of her 5 sons, Serge, took the train to his mother's house from home to Paris to introduce her to his new baby. He had been poking around online, he told her during the visit, and had found someone with the same name as her dad, Dumont. Fernandez contacted the man through the genealogy site where Serge found him and sent him a note. A week went by and she was disappointed to see that he hadn't replied, but she did notice an Argentine flag on his profile. With the help of Google Translate, she resent her message, this time in Spanish. I think my mother is your half-sister, she wrote. 2 weeks later, in March 2014, Bittu Bingu boarded a plane in Brussels with Fernandez, Serge, and one of her other sons. Stepping into the arrivals lounge in Chaco, Argentina, the 4 were greeted by dozens of cheering, never-before-met relatives, many of them blonde and blue-eyed. "Welcome," read their hand-lettered signs and banners, "Family of the World." Bitubingi and Dumont ran immediately to each other and stood in a tight embrace, tears streaming down their cheeks. The Belgian state had told her that her father didn't care, said Fernandez, that he didn't want anything to do with her. In fact, her dad, whose first wife, an Argentine, had died in a plane crash after giving birth to three children, has told his kids to one day look for their half-sister. "Now she's found these 10 brothers and sisters and their children and grandchildren," says Fernandez. "A whole family at the age of 65. Tavares Muyinga, Nagalula, and other Katende alumni, Marie Jose Loshi, were sharing one of their regular meals together in 2018. They're the closest of friends. And debating whether the government's Matisse initiative was likely to have any impact on their lives. Bitubingi still tenses up every time a truck rumbles past her house. "The nightmares never end," she said. "That the military trucks are coming, that we are running away, the body parts, the babies, all of that. I would like to ask the state, how can I keep all of that in my head for all these years?" Again, it was Fernandez who took the initiative. Reaching out to a Brussels-based lawyer, Michelle Hirsch, who worked with victims of rape and other violent crimes. At first, Hirsch declined a meeting with the women, explaining that she only deals with criminal law. "Yes," Fernandez told her, "that's exactly what we need." A few weeks later, five alumni of Contende rang the buzzer at the offices of Hirsch and Van Heist on a leafy street in Brussels' upscale Louise neighborhood. They were Bitubingi, Tavares Muyinga, Nagalula Loshi, and Noelle Verbecken. One by one, the women gathered around a conference table, recounted the full stories of their girlhoods, most of them for the first time. "They hadn't even told their children," Hirsch said. "That is part of the trauma. We saw that what happened with the Holocaust and with the genocide in Rwanda. I met women. They didn't talk of their own experiences of being raped, but they told the stories of their husbands, their sons, who had been murdered. We didn't understand immediately," she went on. "We had never heard about this." Hirsch, who has quite a quiet ferocity and a penchant for chunky jewelry, began digging into the state archives, engaging academic experts, and with her colleagues, creating dossiers for the five women. "These documents are extraordinary," she said. "They prove that the Belgian state, during colonization, put in place a system to take very young children between 2 and 4 years old from their mothers, all of them Métisses, to put them under the power of the state and place them by force in religious institutions in a manner to preserve the supremacy of whites. This was not an orphan," she continued. "This was not an abandoned child. The church sequestered these children. All of that was dressed up in decrees and rules. Because none of the individuals responsible for the system remain alive today, Hirsch and her clients took the case to the state, bringing civil suit against the government. They requested reparations of a mere 50,000 euros per person and the appointment of an expert to assess the mental, physical, and financial hardships the women had suffered. They settled on a small sum because losing the case would mean paying a portion of the state's legal fees. The Catholic Church is not part of the women's lawsuit. That doesn't mean it bears no responsibility for the atrocities. Without the church, there wouldn't have been no way to put the system in place," said Hirsch. "The state delegated the power to the church with the understanding that the church would not let the kids go back to their families. In order to get paid, the church needed documents saying, 'We entrust this child to you.'" Hirsch emphasizes that the oldest plaintiff in the suit, Tavares Muyinga, arrived at Contende in 1948. That was 3 years after the Allies in World War II had established the concept of crime against humanity, defining it as murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhumane acts committed against any civilian population before or during the war. They also referred to persecution on political, racial, or religious grounds. Hirsch could imagine the sort of arguments she and her clients would hear, including equivocation with Leopold's atrocities. "Everyone is going to tell us, yes, and they cut their hands off, and they did this and that in other countries. No, our clients are living. And when they were children, after 1948, they took these measures in Belgium territory. Since when," she continued, "when one commits a crime, do they say, 'Excusez-moi, That's valuable to whom? A state must take responsibility. On a chilly afternoon in October 2021, Gauchebourg and a few hundred crammed into a nondescript courtroom in downtown Brussels to lend support to the five Matisse plaintiffs. During the hearing, which lasted only a few hours and did not include live testimony, Hirsch argued that her clients have been abducted, abused, and ignored and expelled from the world. They are living proof of an unconfessed state crime, and soon there would be no one left to testify. The government's lawyer acknowledged that the policies in question had been racist and shameful, but he maintained that the policies hadn't been seen as violating fundamental rights at the time they were put in place. Besides, he said, if the state were to make payouts to these women, how many of the other approximately 4,000 Métis in Belgium would file lawsuits? In his decision, delivered 2 months later, the judge sided with the state. The public response, in keeping with the larger societal trend toward denial about the colonial past, was muted. A part of Belgian society, mostly, but not exclusively the older generations, still seems somewhat hesitant at the idea of recognizing too many wrongs. And some of our politicians still insist on highlighting the good sides of colonization, Laurers, the archivist, explained. After 2 years of interviews and hearings, a parliamentary commission set up in 2020 was unable to persuade the Belgian Chamber of Representatives to issue even an apology. Hirsch and her clients have appealed the ruling and have been given a deadline of May 2023 to submit final arguments. Gauchebourg, for her part, has been working with the Switzerland-based organization Justice Initiative, which focuses on child abuse. She believes that the Métis may have a sound legal case in the European Union, predicated on the systematic discrimination and violation of the rights of a child. Hirsch points to Canada and Australia, both of which publicly reckoned with discriminatory policies involving Indigenous and half-caste children in 2021. In the former case, several lawsuits have led to settlements in the billions of dollars for the harm done to Indigenous people through a system of mandatory residential schools that a national commission called cultural genocide. Australia's government agreed to pay $280 million to survivors who were removed from their families in federally controlled areas of the country. The United States recently acknowledged its role in an assimilation campaign that required Native American families to send their children to government-run boarding schools during the turn of the 20th century. Hirsch believes Belgium will eventually acknowledge its past crimes and enact reparations for all the Métis taken from their families. In the meantime, she is adamant that her clients will prevail. If Belgium doesn't face this story, Bitubingi said, the trauma will be passed down from generation to generation. It did it. It must pay. We'll move on to an article in the prologue section titled More Than Anne by Vanessa Braganza. The life of L.M. Montgomery was less charmed than her most beloved heroine might have you believe. On a warm golden day in early August, I sat by the lake in the area of Park Corner on Prince Edward Island, where Lucy Maud Montgomery, author of the beloved 1908 children's novel, Anne of Green Gables, spent her childhood summers. Sunlight glittered on the water. A soft breeze played among the reeds and feathery grasses. The view from my picnic basket inspired stories and settings that have enraptured readers worldwide for more than a century. Montgomery's tale of the imaginative orphan, Anne Shirley, captured the minds of so many people that she and her red-headed heroine quickly became global literary sensations. And the palpable enchantment that lingers over the Park Corner house, originally the home of the novelists Auntie Annie and Uncle John Campbell, Montgomery found a haven to give her imagination free rein. She later called the house the wonder castle of my childhood. It is now the Anne of Green Gables Museum, owned by George Campbell and managed by Pamela Campbell. The two siblings are great-grandchildren of Annie and John Campbell. Today, of course, Montgomery's name is nearly inseparable from Anne of Green Gables, and many fans think of her and Anne as the same person. But by the author's own account, readers have been wrong for more than a century. People were never right in saying I was Anne, she told a fellow writer, Ephraim Weber, in a 1922 letter. But in some respects, they will be right if they write me down as Emily. She was referring to Emily of New Moon, a later novel, the first in a series about the difficulty of making it as a young female writer. I had come to Park Corner to walk in Montgomery's footsteps and see the world from which she spun stories that blended fantasy and reality. Yet, her fiction, synonymous with bright, idyllic settings and bubbly heroines, also had a darker side. And the picturesque beauty of Park Corner felt at odds with the sober vibe of Emily, 1923, her bleakest and most serious book. You should go to New Moon, Pamela Campbell said when I confessed my interest in the lesser-known Emily. The house, she said, is just down the road. On February 15, 1922, at her home in Ontario, Canada, Montgomery set her pen down in triumph. Today, I finished Emily of New Moon after 6 months writing, she announced in her journal. It is the best book I have ever written, and I have more intense pleasure in writing it than any of the others, not even excepting Green Gables. I have lived it, and I hated to pen the last line and write Finney. A century after its 1923 publication, Emily is powerful and disquieting, a view into the author's sometimes embattled life. The novel and its two sequels tell the story of Emily Starr, a young girl who weathers prejudices and challenges to achieve her dream of becoming a published author. Emily, like Anne, is an orphan, but there the resemblance ends. Anne finds not only a home, but kindred spirits who fall under the spell of her gift for seeing beauty and possibility in the world. In the Anne novels, the emotional complexity of Montgomery's art lies in the way that adult characters who are hardened in some way, the stern Marilla, Anne's adoptive mother, or the rigid widow, Aunt Josephine Barry, become more compassionate human beings under Anne's influence. Montgomery's perceptive insights into such relations became her trademark. In Emily, though, generational relations play out differently. After her father dies, Emily is adopted by her dead mother's family, the Murrays of New Moon, and finds herself at the mercy of her strict Aunt Elizabeth, who forbids her from reading or writing stories. Emily finds it maddening that nobody could see that she had to write. She is obsessed with words, their sound, their music, and the magic of finding the right ones, which sparks a thrill of inspiration that she calls the flash. Aunt Elizabeth's harshness is calculated to clip the wings of Emily's imagination. No Murray of New Moon has ever been guilty of writing stories, the narrator of Emily tells us. It was an alien growth that must be pruned off ruthlessly. Aunt Elizabeth plied the pruning shears and found no pliant, snippable root, but that same underlying streak of granite. Like the novels of Louisa May Alcott or Mary Wollstonecraft, Emily made the then revolutionary point that young women's literary ambitions deserve to be taken seriously. Emily's granite stubbornness emboldened her to find ways to defy her aunt's ban on words. From spending her egg money on paper to scribbling poems on old letter bills, government-issued records of the mail delivered to post offices. Aunt Elizabeth is very cold and haughty, Emily writes in a diary. When Aunt Elizabeth insists on reading her private writing, Emily burns the diary, mentally adding to the entry in her mind, and she is not fair. To some extent, Montgomery did base the Anne and Emily characters on herself, even inserting passages from her diaries wholesale into the novels. But while Anne was a charm story, Emily was in many respects closer to the author's reality. After her mother died in 1876, Montgomery's father left his infant daughter in the care of her maternal grandparents in Cavendish, Prince Edward Island. The elderly couple were a far cry from Marilla and Matthew, the brother and sister who adopt Anne. The young Maud's willful, imaginative personality frequently clashed with her grandparents' strict conservatism. Grandfather McNeil, in all the years I knew him, was a stern, domineering, irritable man, Montgomery wrote in her own diary in 1905. Grandmother was kind to me in her own way, she continued. Her way was often torture to me, and I was constantly reproached with ingratitude and wickedness. Another adult who played a formative role in Montgomery's childhood was her maternal aunt, Emily McNeil Montgomery, who babysat young Maud before marrying and moving to a new homestead, a house in Malpique called New Moon. But Aunt Emily is not, as her aim might suggest, Montgomery's inspiration for the heroine in New Moon. In fact, she probably inspired quite a different character, the haughty Aunt Elizabeth. As for Aunt Emily, Montgomery wrote in the same 1905 diary entry, "I've never cared for her. She jars on me in every fiber. She has no intellectual qualities. She is unsympathetic, fault-finding, nagging, and touchy. I can never forgive her for the sneers and slurs she used to call upon my childish ambitions and my childish faults." These lines describe the fictional Aunt Elizabeth to a T. By the time Montgomery began writing Emily in August 1921, she had already shot to international fame, but the road to renown had been fraught. In her 1917 memoir, The Alpine Path, Montgomery recalled a poem that she had clipped from a women's magazine as a child and pasted into her writing portfolio for inspiration. Echoing her own ambition, the poem's speaker wandered, "How I may reach the far-off goal of true and honored fame and write upon its shining scroll a humble woman's name." The question is a poignant reminder of the obstacles early 20th century women writers faced, even those who, like Montgomery, defied the norms that curtailed the aspirations of many women. During this era, Canadian law often did not recognize women as persons, barring them from participating in political life and sharply limiting their financial independence. Aunt Emily's animus towards her niece's achievements became family lore. Pamela Campbell recalls stories her mother told her. On one occasion, Aunt Emily began to read one of Montgomery's books, but threw it down in disgust. There was another book Montgomery wrote called A Tangled Web, Campbell adds, and Emily started to read it and said, "I'm ashamed to know her," and shut the book. The source of Aunt Emily's antagonism toward Montgomery remains unclear. Campbell recalls, "My mother thought maybe there was resentment. Maybe Aunt Emily saw herself in the book." To this day, Montgomery's descendants report a family rumor that Aunt Emily herself longed to be a writer. So perhaps what she saw in Emily was a version of her own disappointment, hopes, and dreams. Poignantly, Montgomery's colossal achievements came to the point of ostracism and censure from members of her own family. "I drove until the road met the ocean. At last, I spotted the house from behind. There seemed to be a shadow over it. Perched high atop the red cliffside, stark and flanked by firs, New Moon would only be fully visible from the ocean, so I waded out into Malpique Bay. As the chilly wavelets crept up my ankles and I turned back to face the house, I felt a surge of gratitude toward the author who climbed the Alpine Path, whose stories had defined my own childhood and inspired me to become a writer." A century after Emily's release, she has not only inscribed a woman's humble name on readers' hearts, her vision has shaped a future in which readers like me could dare to imagine and write. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Steadfast by Shannon Sims. "Majestic and sturdy, the live oak tree has offered protection time and time again. I saw in Louisiana a live oak growing. All alone stood it, and the moss hung down from the branches." Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass, 1860-61. More than 150 years after Whitman wrote those lines, the southern live oak still embodies the American ideal of individual resilience, a stoic figure standing tall. Of the country's more whimsical-looking trees, the live oak is also one of the strongest. Indeed, it has saved the lives of thousands of people who have clung to its limbs during hurricanes. In these days, scientists appreciated its extraordinary capacity for absorbing atmospheric carbon, a bonus in the era of climate change. However solitary the live oak might appear, a species is working hard to ensure our collective survival. Native to the United States, Quercus virginiana is known for its longevity. The trees can live for over 1,000 years, and for its signature limbs and with their sinuous, gangly quirkiness. Southern live oaks get their name because, unlike oaks that lose their leaves in the winter, live oaks regrow their foliage throughout the year, so their leaves are unfailingly lush, adorning the southeast from Virginia down the east coast and through south to the Texas and Oklahoma, with low-hanging branches that seem to beckon climbers. These rugged trees tend to grow inland from coastal dunes and are considered the longtime keystone species of the maritime forests of the American South, because they offer crucial support to the remarkably diverse hosts of species. Their famously deep and hardy roots, meanwhile, give live oaks impressive staving power. The live oak has nourished and protected the continent's inhabitants for many centuries. Beginning in pre-Columbian America, native peoples have ground the tree's acorns into meal and know its strong roots could be counted on during disasters. In the late 1700s, the U.S. Navy recognized the tree's toughness and its curved limbs ideal for ship hulls and began using it to make particularly sturdy vessels. The world's oldest ship still afloat, the USS Constitution, launched in 1797, got its nickname Old Ironsides during the War of 1812 after its hull, made in part of live oak, proved itself equal to the fearsome cannons of the British. The physician and poet Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. called the impregnable vessel the Eagle of the Sea, a floating proxy for America itself. The tree's fortitude has become even more important in the era of climate change, and the live oak still represents a life raft for those in paths of tropical storms. Resistant to salt water, the trees serve as a defense against extreme weather, with deep roots that hold fast and downward curling branches that offer shelter from high winds. While the dunes and barrier islands are effective in mitigating storm surges and high winds, the next round of defense is the maritime forest, explains Paul Manos, a professor of biology at Duke University, who has studied oaks for most of his career. Live oaks are not very tall, but very broad, and they are biomechanically adept at handling high winds because the winds go right over them. Equally important, the live oak is thought to be one of the most efficient trees in the world at capturing carbon because of its large canopy, dense wood, and impressive longevity, which is why Douglas Tallamy, an entomologist and wildlife ecologist at the University of Delaware, sees oaks as an important part of long-term solutions to climate change. Live oak survival skills are on vivid display if you drive through southwest Louisiana to the Gulf of Mexico. You won't see many structures near the end of the road. Fences, businesses, and homes have been demolished by a series of storms over the past decade, but you will see big, beautiful oak trees centuries old. So many people over the generations have ridden out storms here by holding fast to the branches of a live oak. Historians have traced this practice to a native trapper in the 1800s who taught settlers how to tie themselves to these storm trees during hurricanes. There are still locals who tell me they rode out a catastrophic 1957 storm that way. The current president of the Live Oak Society is 1,200 years old. One of the vice presidents has a trunk more than 10 feet in diameter. One of the most famous is Angel Oak, a Titan 400 or more years old on John's Island in South Carolina. A low country tourist attraction because of its majestic beauty, it is protected from developers. Across the South, other anonymous live oaks lack protections, though anyone can register a given tree for conservation. That way, society knows to intervene if it's threatened. Whitman, of course, found his arboreal muse in Louisiana. And while the live oaks are at the National Arboretum in Washington, D.C., we don't have anything like the Angel Oaks, says horticulturalist Kevin Conrad. To see the real deal, you have to go south. It's almost a spiritual experience to stand underneath these incredible trees. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.